This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
The project itself, just the genesis, was an invitation to 12 artists to spend 6 to 8 months in Israel and the West Bank, and for them at the end of that time to produce a book and a traveling exhibition. And I, who had never been to the region previously, I was at once, perhaps one might say, flattered, but also very intimidated by the notion, and also a bit wary of what that meant. I didn't myself want to be instrumentalized. I didn't. I wasn't sure that I would be able to produce also something that would be worthy of that kind of invitation. So I decided to, in fact, accept the invitation and to say that for some time I would pay my own way and investigate how I felt being in Israel and in the West Bank. And it wasn't until the second or third trip that I sort of found the kernel of something that not only resonated with the trajectory of my own work, but seemed that perhaps it might be something that was adding to the discussion in some way, or touching upon things that were latent and indeed for some reason taboo in the community. And once I touched on that, I began working in a way it was initially an investigation into the legacy of 48. By virtue of being an outsider, one has the opportunity to move fluidly between one community and another, which I think was a pretty extraordinary thing for us, and to remain open, or to try to remain open to the voices and the histories of both sides. And so I just give you one anecdote, was that, you know, in the early time of interviewing combatants, people who had been fighting on either side of the divide at 48, Arabs and Israelis, I was so struck by the rupture of what that time had meant, and how Israelis were speaking about how then they were raised when they were children, they were speaking Arabic, and what this sort of extraordinary fissure that had been created at that time in the country and the region. And so my investigation really started with that, started with looking at the legacy of 48, visiting the sites of combat, and through that then beginning to come in contact with people who knew the villages that had been evacuated. And then following the trajectory of that line from the place that had once been inhabited across a divide to the place where the people were now living. So you have a story of somebody who left a village 65 years prior. You can go to that place. You can be the conduit across a divide, in many instances from the West Bank to areas within Israel, which to me seemed a really kind of extraordinary privilege.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things that has interested me in the project too is you know, because you did create it in separate parts, right? So that, I mean, it's replicated in some way, partly in this exhibition. You walk in, and the first part of the project is the memory trace part of the project, and then you go to Desert Bloom. And although it's not represented in this iteration of the project, there's a third section called Independence Nakba. Which is a series of diptychs of persons from both sides of the separation wall. And these are, I mean, just to tell you, because I'll return to this later, I don't want to discuss it now, but just so that you have a sense of what that project is, it's a series of diptychs. There are 65 diptychs, one diptych for each of the years from 1948 to 2013. And they're in order of age. So the first diptych are 2 1-year-olds, the second diptych are 2 2-year-olds, and all the way to the last diptych, which is a diptych of 2 65-year-olds. So you have the three sections. I mean, we have the additional Al-Aqib section here in Slot, which I'll ask you about later. But I was wondering if you could say something about the discreteness, but also the relation between the three parts, and not simply the relation between them, but why this particular order? Why, when you created the project, why was memory trace the first thing that had to take place? And why did it have to take place before you could go to Desert Bloom? And why Desert Bloom is next, and then why you close with Independence Nakba? And I want to also, I know that you've talked about in an interview about the way in which each of the parts of the project reference 48. So there's a way in which 48 is this constant reference. But you're also taking the photographs in these years between 2010 and 2015, I suppose. And so there is a relationship that gets established between the past and the present, and sort of the trauma of 48 and its survival, let's say, and iteration in future years. So I was wondering if you could just say something about the relationship, but also what for you was the order in which this had to unfold in order to tell the story the way you wanted to. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think at the outset, that's not something one can intuit. You know, you start with a thread of something that seems like a reasonable inquiry, and for me, it had to be something about openness and vulnerability and an investigation of something that I wasn't sure where it would lead. And in this thread, there is a very clear link between these three projects that are part of this trilogy, but it was, when you look at it, in retrospect, it seems, that it was clearly thought out, but in fact, it was far more organic than that. It was about first looking at these stories, as I was saying, from 48 and the people who had been evacuated. And then it was little moments for me in most of my projects. It's little moments or encounters that then provide a kernel of a question that I want to investigate with the process of making images or interviewing. And so, in the course of working on the memory trace testimonies and traveling to those sites, I was invited to the south to a village, Al-Araqib, which had recently been razed to the ground. And we sat there out in one of these protest tents. What often happens is when they raise the village, the villagers themselves continue to build small little shacks as a kind of protest on the land in which they once lived. Often the IDF would come back the next day, each time demolishing the site, and then they would start again, anew, even that afternoon, to build again. And sitting there in one of these shacks with one of the villagers, speaking about how only months before this land that I was looking out upon had been a village. Now, we were sitting under one of these sort of lean-to tents, looking out upon an area that was not only had been razed to the ground, but was being bulldozed to form the Ambassador Forest. It would, in 20 years, be a JNF forest. So there immediately I saw this notion of a kind of a link to the images and the way in which I was seeing 48, a desire, because of not knowing or understanding what he was saying about the land, to see it from above, which is something that never really interested me in the past. And once I did fly aloft above the desert, I realized that there was this very close connection between the way in which land had been wrested from communities in 48 and what was happening now in the southern part of the desert in the Negev, the way in which the invocation to make the desert bloom was transforming this land. And that, in a way, the aerial images when I was first flying above the land, I didn't even know exactly what it was I was looking at. It was something about trying to be receptive to what the land had to show one. The same way in which sometimes you think about a portrait, trying to be receptive and open to what somebody offers you, and then trying to find the way to follow the signifiers to what it is actually you're looking at. And so here there was a kind of a close connection, follow-on to Desert Bloom. And from there, very briefly, was always this idea for me was the desire to be able to work in both communities and to make something that was open and empathetic across that divide. And I think in the last piece, this Independence Nakba, this series of diptych images. I think there what was interesting for me was how does one express the wound that's been rendered on the community? How does one articulate, find a way to articulate that expanse of time since 48? Then it was 65 years. And so the simplest, most direct route for me seemed just in a very straightforward rendering of people on both sides of the divide.
I want to follow that up by reframing, let's say, some of what you've said in relation to a broader question, which is the question of how and if photography can present what is before the camera, or how and if photography can be a means of remembrance, commemoration, and memory in some way, especially when there are forces that seek to make that remembrance, commemoration, and memory difficult, if not impossible. So I want to think with you a little bit about the relationship between memory and forgetting, or between remembrance and erasure in some way. And perhaps you'll permit me to recall an example that is encrypted in some way in the project. You and I've talked about it. It's somewhat invisible in the project, but it's remained for me a very important marker of something as I try and think about the project. And this is there were initially going to be 66 diptychs, but on the evening before the morning, when Falzel was going to photograph the 66th person, who was an Israeli journalist who had become friends with Falzel, his friend was killed in a motorcycle accident that night. So Falzel was unable to take that 66th portrait. He had another 66-year-old who he could have taken the picture. Did you ever take the picture of the other person? Or you did. So he had another portrait that he could substitute for that one, and he decides that he cannot use that portrait, that he didn't want to substitute someone else for his friend. So this has become very interesting to me, because there's a moment in which Falzel keeps the memory of his friend by removing him from the project. So there's this relationship that gets established between memory and erasure. And I'm, you know, so this is also in the Independence Nakba thing quite marked, I think, in relation to your own work, because the diptychs of these people from both sides of the separation wall are not named in that project. And this is the first time in all of Falzel's work where he doesn't name his subjects. I mean, he's very, very well known for his portraits, and there's an insistence in the portrait work of naming, identifying, giving voice to the person who is pictured. So in the diptychs, in these diptychs, they're anonymous. So there's a way in which, again, you present them, but at the same time, there is a kind of erasure of their specific identity. And so I was wondering if you might be able to say something about the relationship between memory and erasure, specifically in relation to photographic practice, which is to say that to what extent photography, which is meant to remember, record, document, to keep and preserve, is also a means of erasure. I mean, how do you... And so, if that's the case, how do you, as a photographer, seek to either overcome this erasing effort of the photograph, or remain faithful to that double structure of the photograph, the way in which it both preserves and erases at the same time?
I'm very pleased with the notion of the way in which the photograph does erase, or the photograph holds within it all of these layers that are there possibilities. They're subsumed beneath the land. They're within the face. We've spoken about that together. You know, this notion. I mean, this afternoon, this wonderful group of students was here, and we were talking about the landscape as seen from above, and the kind of way in which one learns to read the land, the way in which one sees the wrinkles from above, and how they're signifiers of something that transpired there. You don't know exactly what it is, but you slowly tease out the clues that give you a sense of what it is you're looking at. I mean, that's for me, very much, and surprisingly so, because I was never that engaged really with landscape, but surprisingly similar to the act of portraiture, the way in which, you know, the landscape of the face holds within it all of the person's own history and emotion, and how, as we've spoken also, how that is then met by the viewer. The viewer themselves are bringing to that image all sorts of emotions and their own history, and that will affect their own reading of it. And so for me, the most interesting images are the ones that deny you the chance to explain them away in one fell swoop. They insist that you return to them again and again, and each time you return to them, I don't mean to speak about my image, I mean, the ones that inspire me the most are the ones that when you return to them, they're offering you something different each time. And this is about a kind of layering and a kind of erasure in the best sense, and in the sense of that there is something latent, insistent, emotional there. And that I think that can be the most beautiful aspect of art and photography is when you have all of those layers of complexity.
I'm glad you said that. Because actually one of the things that I wanted to talk about is sort of returning to this relationship between photography and memory, and in particular to the way in which photography, and you've said this before, can become a kind of archaeology. Right? I mean, you say this in the interview that you gave to Shayla Sheikh. And I want to actually remind you of a statement you make in the interview, because I returned to it this morning. And you say at that in the interview, all of the photographs I made are traces not only of the moment that I photographed them, but also the traces which lie just below the surface from some other time, sometimes going back as far as prehistory, to Nabataean era or Byzantine era inventories, or to the remains of recent demolitions in Bedouin villages, including, in fact, the Bedouins still living within the landscape under threat of eviction. In this sense, there are traces of what is already fading, bearing witness not only to a certain presence, but also to the tide of transformation. And that's the end of the quote. And I really love this idea, because what's always interested me is the way in which photographs, they look like a surface. You're looking at a flat surface when you look at a photograph. But within that surface, those surfaces bear the traces of an entire network of historical relations, right? So it looks like a surface, it looks like a flat surface, but it's actually an archive, right? And so that I like the idea of it offering or demanding almost a kind of archaeological effort to excavate what it has sealed within its surface, mm-hmm. or encrypted in its surface. Mm-hmm. And so I think that what's at stake then, and I think you and I have talked about this often, what's at stake in reading a photograph is the possibility of reading historically. Right? So, and I'll say more about that later, I think, in our discussion, but I've often told Fazl that I think that his works come to us in the form of a kind of training manual on how to read historically. Right? And I think this ability is what is necessary to read an image as an archaeological resource. Right? So I think one of the things that you can say then is that these photographs, which are always part of a series, right? You've never just produced one image. It's always linked to a project. It's linked to a context. It's always in a series of other images. And here you have not just the series within each part of the project, but the series that moves from each of the different parts, right? So that this is also linked to how one approaches this particular project, I think, which has been both the glory of it for me, but also the difficulty of it for me, which is that the different parts of it take on a whole set of different figures, right? So portraits, landscapes, ruins, deserts, trees, forests, the Israeli separation wall, etc. And they're presented in relation to one another because they're part of the series, as part of this trilogy that asks us to follow the red threads between them. But these threads are not simply, let's say, historical, political, ideological, religious, or philosophical. They're also visual. Right, so there's a kind of visual echolalia that takes place between the sections, and I was wondering if you could excavate some of that with us. So, for example, when you were talking just a minute ago, you talked about the way in which a face itself becomes a kind of landscape to be read, right? And the landscapes themselves become kinds of faces, right? And if you look at some of the aerial photographs, some of them look like the grain of wood or the roots of trees from looking above. So this effort to create forests on the desert land is almost replicated by what the landscape starts to look like, right? The interiors of some of the mosques and the shrines, I mean, the very first image in the exhibition, if you look closely at that interior, it starts looking like one of the aerial landscapes. You know, so there's a way in which the closer you look at the images, they start revealing these kind of visual echoes among each other, so that it requires a kind of reading that that lets you know, among other things, that the meaning of a single image is never to be located within that image. You know, that it has to be put in relation to other images, just as you're trying to understand the life of a single person can't take place without putting that person in relation to other people, right? And I think that maybe what I'm inviting you to talk about, and I will also say more about this later, because Fazal knows that when I start talking, I threaten to go on forever, like a river. But, you know, that if you could talk a little bit, not only about, let's say, the archaeological aspect of an image, but this, what you would imagine your ideal reader would be capable of in terms of reading these images historically.
Well, I think what Eduardo failed to tell you is that he's been working for ages on a book called Erasures, entitled Erasures, which is about all of the projects. And I think he's trying to take this moment to actually get me to walk through the rest of the book with him. And I think that actually I spent about 5 years trying to make as many different kinds of images to confound him, to get his knickers in such a twist that he'd never be able to produce this book. So I apologize for that fact and for testing his friendship as far as it will go to its limits. But I think that actually, in truth, I mean, working in Palestine and Israel was the most difficult experience I've ever had working. It was the most challenging on many levels, and it was also perhaps one of the few where I suddenly hit upon the things that just seemed so obvious to me, so in keeping with the way I feel about the world and images and people, and I saw that in many of the things. Maybe it's a lot about my own sensibilities, but it also seemed to be so present almost everywhere I looked. It was not at all, I mean, we talk about it in retrospect as though it's something, like I said before, really clear, but it wasn't that way that at all. It was something just about that, what you say, echolalia. I mean, it was just some fever of the things that I saw and the way that they did see inflected in each other and one another, in the land, in the portraits, in the faces. And the thing that I really love is this idea that you're also said you're having a lot of trouble with, because you can do it visually, but then to try and pin it down in a text, this leads to that and links to this, yeah, and that emotion links to that, but then, you know, oh, I'm missing out on that aspect, and somehow how do you, you know, bring it all together in a way also that is generous, the way in which you always write, thoughtful and generous, full of heart and emotion, you know, and I don't really know why that is. It, you know, when you say it, it sounds like it was intentional, but it really wasn't. It's just, maybe it's just luck, or it's, certainly you gather the things together and then you look at them as you're piecing together a publication and you can start to see, oh, this fits with that. And I think a lot about those sorts of things. Right. Text and image also, which is throwing everything off kilter as well. But if that does happen, I'm happy for it. It's just not, it's not willful.
Right. I mean, it's not willful on the one hand, but on the other hand, when you put the project together, for example, I'll just reveal this to everyone here. I mean, the memory trace section, of which you have samples in the first room, in the book, there are 48 images. You know, that's a very significant number in this context, right? So it's a way of also formally, let's say, encouraging everyone to understand that every one of these images has to be read in relation to the history of 48, right? So there's that's willful, right? I mean, you thought about how many images you would put there. But this is to say that I do agree with you that if you read these images historically, then each photograph can be shown to bear a relation to not only all the other photographs in the series, but also to the traces of the entire complicated history of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, right? So it's a history that has to be recalled if this or that photograph is to be read, right? But that these, and this is, I think, what you were saying just a minute ago, that these photographs are entangled with so many conflicting memories and histories, right, is what makes them so difficult to comprehend, so impossible to read in a fixed and determinate manner. Right, so that the danger would be to think, as you're looking at these images, that you can understand what you're seeing, right? That you can fix it in a determinate way. Right. So I like actually that you said that when you were taking these aerial shots, you didn't initially know necessarily what you were seeing. Right. I also think that, I mean, this is a kind of parenthesis. What's great about the aerial shots is it inverts the usual Israeli position over the Palestinians, which is always topographically above. Right? The settlements are very often on hills, so they can surveil. So there's a way in which you reverse the perspective, and now what's happening in these areas is being looked at from above by somebody else's eye. I think that's very important. But I think that the fact that you encourage the viewer to begin to think about the relationships between these images and about what they represent. It's a way of having each viewer undergo a kind of training, right? I mean, so that you come to understand that that meaning unfolds in time, right? You come to understand that in a world where everything can become something else, where faces can become landscapes, where landscapes can become faces, where landscapes can look like trees, like in a world where those things are possible, where everything can become something else, then nothing is ever just itself, right? I think, and that I think is extremely important in relation to this conflict that you're talking about, right? Because one of the extraordinary things about the diptychs, just so that you know, and some of these diptychs are on the website, on Slot's website, is that as you're looking at the diptych, again, of two people, each from a different side of the separation wall, it is impossible to look at both persons at the same time equally. Like, it's impossible, right? Your eye has to choose who it's going to focus on. Right? You can only look at one of them at a time. Right? And I think this stages part of the dilemma. Right? It's impossible to look at both sides equally at the same time. And I think that that is also something that forces a viewer who's paying attention to what's happening when they're trying to look at the diptych all at once, is that you can never see an image all at once. Mm-hmm. Right? So that in order to see an image, to read an image, you have to go through the kind of excavation and the putting in relation to other images, to multiple histories, etc. And I think that this is a kind of amazing thing. But I think, because I had said I wanted to return to the diptychs at some point, I just want to say that one of the things that is remarkable about ending with that section is because it's the strongest way of putting these histories together, I mean, in the way that you also did when you talked about it briefly earlier, saying that some of the people who are now on the Israeli side actually grew up speaking Arabic, right? There were all kinds of relations that were interrupted by the installation of that, of what happened in 48, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. So that there were more complicities, more relations already before that event. So that event, as you said, installs a kind of rupture, mm-hmm, or break, a wound that has never healed, as you say. And if that wound has never healed, that means that we are not yet over that history, right? There's no historical after to a trauma in some way. But one of the things that I was thinking about in terms of that complicity one of the things that's remarkable as you go through that series of diptychs is that little by little, the two people, you start seeing visual resemblances between the two people. It's almost impossible, even if it's a man and a woman, you know, you start seeing resemblances between the two sides, which is a remarkable thing as you go. You also register, for example, that the Palestinian side ages more quickly, right? So they start looking older as you move through the sequence, right? But I think it is the section of the project that demands an empathy in relation to the two sides, a kind of complicity, to a registration of a relation across the divide that has been installed because of the wall, right? And I think that one of the things that I've thought about in relation to that is the way in which, of course, there is this play always in that conflict between victory and defeat, right? And the sort of the ambiguity of victory and defeat. And as you know, one of the ways in which I've tried to think about that is by returning to a passage from Walter Benjamin's review, 1930 review of Ernst Jünger's collection of essays, War and Warriors. It's an essay in which he talks about, it's an essay he writes actually only a few months after the 1929 Palestinian riots. And in the passage, he talks about what it means to win or lose a war. And what he tries to talk about, among other things, is the way in which the victor wins the war. Okay, so the victor wins a war on the one hand, but wins the war meaning keeps the war, right? And the one who's defeated loses the war, so is defeated, but on the other hand, is freed from the war. So he's very interested in the ambiguity of that phrase, this phrase, what it means to win or to lose a war. And so the victor, by winning the war, keeps the war, which is to say, is always at war, can never really declare himself the victor because the war is ongoing in some way. Whereas the one who loses the war is at some point freed from the war. And so what he's interested in that passage are the ambiguities that take place in the rhetoric with which we talk about who wins and who loses. And I think one of the things that's so moving about that series of diptychs is that you register that no one has won, mm-hmm, right? Nobody has won. And then in fact that...
It's not decisive,
right? And that in fact that what you register is that everyone that is portrayed is mourning themselves in one way or another. They're mourning themselves, they're mourning a particular history, they're mourning beloved ones, etc. So I don't know if this is going to go to a question or not, but I think that one of the things that I would be interested in hearing you talk about is, because this is something that we were talking about even this morning, is what is the work that these photographs can do, right? What is the work that you would hope that they would be able to do? I mean, I said that what's so moving about the diptychs for me is that they establish a relation across a separation, mm-hmm, right? Across, there's a way in which that it's a separation that at the same time binds the two people on both sides, binds them both to that history of separation, but also suggests a relation that could potentially, possibly, overcome that. And I'm wondering, you know, because I guess I'm wondering what force you think photography can have in this context. Can it do what you want it to do? What would be the condition or the register or the litmus that something happened?
I mean, I thought for many years that photography could do just that, you know, that you could use the medium, use the act of making the process to open a conversation and to also invite other people who are viewers to a conversation, not to present them with a kind of fait accompli or something that is perfectly packaged, encapsulated, but rather to complicate things, that they look through a piece, they read a book, they visit an exhibition. It's not pointed in what the end is, but rather it's making them embroiled in the same kind of investigation and to open up the mode of conversation. And I think that, you know, Israel-Palestine is so confounding, and what an arrogance to think that you could spend a few years there and offer some, you know, a summation of what lies within a conflict that is, you know, many people better than me have tried to rein it in. But what I do think is interesting is to somehow make the viewer have the same kind of experience as I did living and working there, because it was at once compelling and fascinating, but also extremely complicated and extremely and often infuriating. And so you had to find the moment at which you could be measured about something, you know, at which you could approach it without anger and in a way that was about the healing aspect of making, right? And so for me, and I mean, that goes back to other projects in which I've worked on. I mean, I'm not really interested in making something that is in line with what you already know or in keeping with a carefully sort of packaged understanding of place. And this is the place that just, I mean, it defies that on every single level.
I know that we wanted to keep the discussion to this project. I'm just going to make a very quick detour to an earlier project because I think it's linked exactly to what you are talking about. 2004, the Moksha project is around 2004. Fazel did a project entitled Moksha, which focuses on dispossessed widows in India. You may know that in India, when the husband dies, very often the widows are deprived of property, of rights, kicked out of the house. So historically, thousands of these widows have made the pilgrimage to the city of Vrindavan, which is now known as the City of Widows. Vrindavan was the childhood playground of Krishna. So the widows go to this city, they devote themselves to Krishna in order to achieve moksha, which is heaven or salvation. So if you, what's sort of amazing, we were talking about this morning, for me, about that project, is if you look at the project, if you look up the book, and actually I should say that Fazel has an extraordinary website where you can see the projects in their entirety, you can download things from them for free. It's part of the effort to make this material available to a broad audience. But if you look at the Moksha project, which is this project where, let's say, this photographer wants to expose the plight of these dispossessed widows, when you open it up, the first thing you see are photographs of images of the history of Krishna, of the story of Krishna. You turn the pages, and then all of a sudden there are these blurred images of the entrance into the city of Vrindavan. Turn the pages, and then you have the first portrait in this book of portraits. And the first portrait is of a widow with her back to the camera and a shawl over her. You can't see her at all. Now, I think this is extremely smart, right? Because you have this book. You have this book that wants to expose the plight of the dispossessed widows. But effectively what it says is, if you want to imagine seeing these women, you have to pass through the story of Krishna, You have to pass through the history of this city, which is not just any history or any city. And even then, you may not be able to see these women directly. Right? And then he proceeds to give you the full straight-on portraits of these women. Right? So that when you're looking at them straight on, you still are haunted by that sequence, which from the very beginning questions the very possibility of showing or displaying or exposing who this person is. So you have this, let's say, in quotation marks, human rights photographer who wants to expose the plight of the dispossessed women, but within that project, you have a meditation on the difficulty, if not impossibility, of showing these women, right? Which I think is extraordinary. And I think that exactly what you said just now, that you never would presume to be able to show and display the complexity of this history, so that there's a way in which all you can do is gesture to hand out or hand over these vestigia of memories, right? Of multiple memories, right? And then ask us to engage them, right? And invite us, I think, to read historically. So I don't know how much time we have, but maybe I'll just one more. I want to maybe close with a reference to Darwish, because I know that Darwish, Mahmud Darwish is, of course, one of the most beloved and well-known Palestinian poets, and his poetry punctuates different moments of this project. Right? And there's one poem called The Humor of Eternity, which I've sent to Fazl. And it's a poem that is about how you register the dead, how you remember the dead. And he talks about somebody who dies, a friend of his who dies in Paris and who's buried in Paris. But because this person is buried in Paris, in a city, which is so his graveyard is surrounded by cafes, museums, people walking in the streets, flowers, etc. There's a way in which you don't have to think of that person as fully dead. It's almost as if the person is just sleeping because he still maintains a relation to things that are alive. And he then contrasts that to somebody who's buried in the desert. And the way in which the person who's buried in the desert cannot pretend to be asleep because he's not surrounded by cafes and museums and so on. So that one who is buried in the desert, it's impossible to be seduced by the metaphor of sleep, and you have to confront the death that takes place in the desert more directly in some way. And he says that the people who bury people in the desert, who then put photographs on the graves, don't put photographs on the graves in order to say this person still retains a relation to life, but they put the photographs on the graves to teach history how to read. Right? And I think that one of the things that I think you do is you put photographs alongside the graves and ruins and traces of these histories. Right? And you ask history to read. You try and teach history to read. And I just wanted to, I want to invite you to talk about that a little bit, but I want to say that I think that that is one of the gifts that you give us.
Sweet.
So you can say something.
Just thank you. I don't really know how to respond to that, but it's... I guess I feel just as though somehow the things that I'm approaching are all very profoundly connected to something within me that seems very obvious and emotional, and I can't always express what it is that, you know. What that kernel of understanding is. But when it hits you, you kind of run with it and it feels right. So if that's something that sometimes you feel, I'm very heartened by that. I mean, I hope very much that, and I'm losing a little bit sometimes that sense that, you know, the engagement with the process and the kind of way in which you can offer things up for consideration, how it's apprehended now is, I'm not in some moments I'm not entirely sure of the impact. But then when I take a deep breath and I sort of step back and I think, well, you know, you can't measure, you shouldn't try and measure the full impact. You should just try and somehow continue to the next thing that seems right for you and then let that somehow be.